Hello, my name is Caroline Eford, and I am here with Jeff Balfrey in Meissenheimer, North Carolina in Stanley County, and today is June 24th, 2018. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Jeff Balfrey, sitting here with Caroline here in the great town of Meissenheimer.
So, thank you. So, to get us started off, could you tell me a little bit about your grandparents?
Okay, on my mother's side, it was Horace Paul, and his wife died shortly after my mother was born, which had been back in the 1920s. So I never knew one of my grandmothers. Pop Paul, we used to call him, and he worked a machinist. He worked for a lot of different manufacturing things over the years. He worked at the Packard Motor Car Company in Philadelphia at one time, and did other things like that. He taught me a lot of things about how to build stuff, you know, how to fix stuff. He would come down from Philadelphia, like, and spend a week or two with us every summer. And, you know, I was following around. I was like 10 years old, 12 years old. I'd follow him around because I knew where to find all the tools, because I probably hid most of them or lost them. And so learned a lot from him on how to do things, how to, you know, think about fixing stuff and all. My other grandfather, my dad's father, he was Millard Balfrey. He and his wife was Elizabeth Deakin, D-E-A-K-I-N, Balfrey. And he also up in the lived in Morristown, New Jersey. Excuse me. He worked, you know, a lot of different jobs. He worked in the Philadelphia shipyards during World War II. Him and his brother did a lot of adventures earlier in life. Some of the things that my great uncle would tell, a lot of stories. We don't know how much of those were real or embellished, but he mostly worked in maintenance type thing. He worked as a loom fixer for Collins and Aikman in Philadelphia, and then the last few years of his, you know, working life, he worked as a custodian for high school in Willingboro, New Jersey. So then moved to Florida in the 70s and passed away in the 90s. So.
Did any of those stories your great uncle would talk about, did any stick out in your mind that you want to share?
I wished I'd have taped those things back then, because we just used to sit there just amazed at the stories he would tell. Like they told, like, one time they were hoboing, you know, they were like, they hop on a train, ride somewhere, and, you know, and get off and work for, you could walk up, find some work and go and work for a couple of days or a week, whatever. And when you find you didn't want to move on, you know, just go ask the paymaster and get your money and leave. And so it's just come and go work. He said there's one place they're working on a tunnel in Pittsburgh, and they decided, oh, let's go. Him and his buddy, or it may not have been my grandfather, but him and a buddy decided, oh, let's go somewhere else. And he said later on they found out about a day or so later there was an explosion in that tunnel that, you know, a bunch of guys got killed in. So, you know, and then he's talking about, he would tell like stories, some of those were probably really fabricated, but but he had a quite adventurous life, you know, growing up in the early 1900s.
And what do you mean by adventurous?
Going around, you know, they were boxing. I think him and my grandfather both were boxers at the time. And mostly probably not professional anything, but probably, you know, like a couple guys get together and box, you know, and everybody be placing the bets and stuff. And so, you know, they would scoop up on that, like betting and stuff. So.
How do you think your grandmother felt about that?
She was so nice and quiet and reserved and everything, and she was just as sweet as could be. She was English. She would stop at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever, and have tea and biscuits. I mean, one time when I was 10 years old, I got to spend a week with them in New Jersey all by myself, none of my brothers and sisters. So it was kind of fun. And she would stop, you know, I just thought that was how I learned how to drink tea with milk in it, because she would stop and fix tea and then lay it all out on the table and just take me a little break. And it was kind of interesting because later in years when she had what was probably Alzheimer's, and she would come up and had been so nice and sweet and all that, and she had some real outbursts at times. Like she would cuss like a sailor. We were like, oh my goodness, you know. But, yeah, it was kind of sad to see that part because by then I was in college. But, you know, she was just a sweet, dear lady.
Do you know anything about the medical care she got as she got older?
No, ma'am, because like I say, they moved to Florida at that time, so we didn't see them a whole lot. So, and of course, I think in the 70s, there wasn't a whole lot about Alzheimer's then. I don't even know if they had it identified as being called Alzheimer's. But, you know, she definitely, you know, did not have her faculties in her mind. You could tell. One time she wandered off, you know, so we had to go help find her. She walked down the road about half a mile from the little country road we lived on. So you did have to kind of keep alert and keep tracking of her.
Now, you said she was English. What brought her to the U.S.?
Well, she was about first generation. You know, she was, but her, she was, came from a family from England, so she's probably second generation by then. So,
she kept the tradition.
And she was born here, yeah.
And then going back a little bit to your pop pop on the other side, what are some of the things that you remember doing with him?
What comes to mind, what we were working one time on the barn, and we took an old door, had come out of the house after a remodeling, and sawed it in half. We were trying to keep the where the horses and cows stuff couldn't get into the feed room. So we took an old door, and he showed me how to, like I say, you know, we were trying to put some hinges on it, and he told me, go get a bar of soap. And what you do is you put soap on the screws so they would make it easier to drive them in. Because we weren't drilling the holes, pre-drilling holes, we were just taking the screw drive in, but just put that little soap on to give it a little bit of lubrication to dry it. And, you know, just how to saw things and you know, the proper way to saw and how to fix stuff, you know, just you know, the way to, and then think through it. Because my dad was an industrial engineer, so he also taught me a lot of mechanical things, you know, how to think through a problem and solve it.
So can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
Okay, my mom was born in Morristown, New Jersey, and was probably 1925, 26, I think. And then she grew up, and her family had a little cottage back there at Lenola Road in Morristown, New Jersey. It was kind of like a weekend cottage and all, and then she actually grew up in Philadelphia, Park Avenue. So actually, it was like a two-story walk-up, whatever. And her dad owned two sections. So he lived the downstairs and rented out the upstairs. And it's right beside what's now Temple University. Actually, Temple University probably run over there by now. But my dad grew up in – he was born in Philadelphia and grew up in Morristown, just the opposite. And they met – she was about 16, I think. And she was over skating on a little place called Strawbridge Lake. And she fell down, and my dad skated over there and picked her up, helped her get up on her feet again. Just think about it. It's just all, it's like all storybook romance here. And they dated on and off. And then, of course, World War II came along. My dad went off to war. And when he came back, he looked up mom. It didn't take him that long because they were married in 1947. So.
Do you know where your father served when he was in the war?
Yes, he was a bomber pilot, B-17s and B-24s in the 8th Army Air Corps, you know, stationed at Lavenham, England, and flew 35 missions over Europe at 19 years old, 19, 20 years old. Yeah. And you think now, you see all the little high school or college kids, oh, we have safe spaces. Like, okay, really? I'm sorry. I have no sympathy. yeah, my father was fighting. You know, he was over Normandy, you know, in the air on D-Day. You know, I mean, so, yeah, he and flying, you know, missions deep into Germany and stuff. So, yeah, he a whole lot different world then than it is now.
Did he talk about his experiences?
Yes, he did. And he would tell stories about, you know, going on certain raids and one of, like, on D-Day, he was actually assigned to fly over Calais, which is Calais was a port in France that Hitler always thought that the invasion would be at Calais, and the Allies did everything they could to convince him that was true. So they would concentrate all of his forces around Calais, but, you know, instead of Normandy. And his actually was supposed to bomb Calais that day, but because they couldn't see because of cloud cover, they circled as long as they could, and they started headed back to England. And typically, back then, they would drop their bombs in the English Channel versus trying to get back landing with. It was dangerous to land the planes with the bombs still in it. But my dad was like, he said, no, we're not wasting these bombs. So he was coming back in. Matter of fact, as he got closer in, he did not have enough gas to get to his field. So he ended up landing at a fighter strip. And the whole time he was coming in, he told the guys, I got to land. I can't go any farther. And they were yelling at him not to do it because the runways were not long enough. And what they finally did, they did land safely. And they ran off the edge of the runway, got tangled up in some barbed wire at the end of the fence. But they were able to pull the plane back up on the runway. And then the commander got real upset when he found out it was full of bombs. They unloaded the bombs because they had to do that for the weight. And he said he actually saw the planes, fighter planes, taking off with his bombs before they got him all reset up. And then he was able to get the thing back off the ground. They gave him enough fuel to get to where he's going. And he said the only thing the commander told him was, do not come back here and buzz this plant, this field. So he got off and took back and got back to his base. But that was his day on D-Day, 6th of June. So.
How long was he a part of the fighting?
He got over, I think, in 44. So into the he was actually finished his 35 missions before Victory in Europe Day. So he was back already back in the United States, and he finished out after he came back as training other pilots. And then after the war stopped, then he got released from the Army and went back into college.
And where did he move when he came back from the war?
He came back to Morristown, where his parents were. And then he first year he went to Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. He was going to be a chemical engineer. And then he did that, I think, for 1 year, and then changed to textiles and industrial engineering. He went to Temple University for a number of years because my mom, like I said, lived right across the street from Temple University, so that was convenient. He worked at Collins and Aikman on second shift, loading, unloading trucks by hand, because his dad worked there as a loom fixer, a maintenance guy. And so he did that. He took his classes there and then ended up getting moved to the after he had a pretty good couple years of college there. He never got his degree. He took all the textile classes and stuff, but never took the liberal arts classes he had to do to finish the degree. And it wasn't until years later, like when he's in his 60s, he finished his degree over at Pfeiffer. So.
Wow. And what about your mother? Did she go to school?
She went, I think, like a, like a business college. She worked as a medical transcriber or office person, like say for a while. Then after they got married, started having children, then she was a housekeeper until she died. So.
And what year did they get married?
1947. So that's post World War II, and five kids. I'm the middle of five, so. I was born in 54, so they were, growing family. We actually, I was born in Philadelphia, but we lived in that house my mom was born at in New Jersey. We lived there for a couple years, and then we moved up to Paramus, New Jersey, which was just outside of New York. And then in 1956, that's a year and a half old, 2 years, we moved to North Carolina when Collins and Aikman came down to start up. There's Collins and Aikman plant in Albemarle. They already had one in Norwood. So we came down as a whole bunch of people came down like from the New York office and all to help start up that plant, which was quite a bit of a culture shock, really. You think about all these Yankees coming down here to Albemarle, North Carolina, which they had just gotten dial phones here at that time. And we had lived right outside of New York City. And I was like, I was two, so I wasn't aware of it. My brother said that, the first thing when they hooked up the TV, he said, Dad, the TV's broke. There's only two channels. Because in New York, they had like 11 channels, VHF channels. And they only had two here at that time. That was Channel 3, and I think maybe Channel 9 was there. But that was it.
Did your parents ever talk about any other culture shock type of things?
No, and I don't remember a whole lot. But what I do remember is that a lot of my parents' friends were folks that had come down together. I think they kind of stuck together because, like all the friends we had, like the best friends that my dad had, was the guy. He was actually a sales guy, I think, for him. And he, our families, they had the same amount of kids and stuff, so we did a lot of stuff together. We did, over time, assimilate with the community and stuff like that, with other people. So it's. You can always tell it's just a little bit out there, a little bit different. But
Can you tell me about your experience of going to school in Albemarle?
Yes, when I first started this elementary school, and back then you walked to school, didn't think anything about it. It wasn't until I think it's second grade before I got my own bicycle. But my first grade, my best friend had a bicycle. And his dad, it's kind of funny because we first moved here. We didn't have any doctor or anything like that. That was in the 50s. And the house that we had like a brick porch in front and had like where you could walk along it. And I was walking along playing guard like on a four or something and fell off and cut up my face. And my dad called the landlord and asked him, you know, where can we go to a doctor? And his wife worked for Dr. Richard Ross in Albemarle. And so we went over there and got my face sewed up. And he went home that day and said, told his wife, we found a friend for Danny. That was his son that was my age. So we were 3 days apart in birth. And Danny and I were best friends until he died at 42. So, but we, let's say, going to school, what you asked me about, going to school and stuff. Danny and I were best friends from day one. We met, the first time we met, we were like on preschool clinic, they used to call it. They'd have like in the March before, you know, just a little half day to get a little feel for it and everything. It was nice. We lived about 4 or 5 blocks from school, so you could walk. Unless it was raining, then Mom would carry us or drop us off. But most of the time, you walk back and forth. There was a little place called K&L Grocery or K&L Drugstore, and they had a little soda fountain and everything that you could stop on. That was on Montgomery Avenue. That was halfway between the school and home. So that was a fun place to stop and get you could get for 10 cents, you could get a Coke and some crackers for 10 cents. That was real good back then. Elementary school was fun. I always enjoyed going to that. I don't know any specific experiences about that, but it was always fun. I was, enjoyed, you know, change classes every year. I was the first class when they added on the part they just renovated at Central Elementary. There used to be a great big old building that was built in the 1910s. I remember doing, you know, chapel programs and events in there. I remember when I was in fifth grade, they tore that down and built that new section that they just remodeled. And, you know, it's got the auditorium and all that. And I was the first class in that building. It's also the first year that we had integration. And it was available, and that was 1965-66. And there's two black kids that came over, Alicia Thomas and her younger brother. And she was in, I can't remember if she was in my class or not, but she was, yes, she was. And she was the first one to come over, you know, from the South Albemarle, what was called Kingville back then. And it wasn't about a year or two later than that, then they actually shut down that school and combined it all. But that was the first year volunteered, and they had a black kids to come over to the white school. So,
what was that experience like?
Never really thought much about it. Some of that may be because I was from up north, and up north it was different. It was more about ethnicity. It was more like, you know, well, you don't like the Italians or you don't like the Irish or something like that. And the black people, they just weren't the same things down here. And I think down here, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, you dealt with black people, you saw them. You know, we had a black maid, a nice lady. My best friend's father, you know, Dr. Ross, he had a maid, Mary, and she was just like a mom to us. I mean, she was my other mom, third mom, really. And if we were doing something we're supposed to, we both got, you know, our bottoms swatted. It didn't matter. You weren't supposed to do it, and you knew that, you know. You didn't say anything. But so, yeah, it was I never had any bad feelings about it myself. You know, when they had the riots and stuff like that, it's like, yeah. That never much of that around here in Albemarle, so never a big issue.
And you mentioned Dr. Ross. Was he were there many doctors in town?
Yeah, there were, I think, plenty of doctors around, yeah. Matter of fact, in the 60s and 70s, he and three or four others, you know, had put together one of the first big practices. When we first started, I remember he was a... It's where, you know, Tiffany's on First and Main. You know, that was the old Louder Hardware store. He was just a couple in that building going more towards north up on First Street. It's a little slot. Actually, there's a little place. I think it's a hair place now. And if you look, there's a little door beside it. He had a long hallway, and you go back in the back, and then that's where his office was. In the back there, that first part with the hair places now. That was a drugstore. Excuse me, Rexall Drugstore. And he was in back behind there. And he also had a room in there for black people. Black people were not allowed to sit down. The white in the room with the other. I didn't understand. I remember one time seeing that, you know, sometimes I was sitting there and they opened the door and, you know, the black, you know, there's a whole room full of black people. I'm like, that's always strange, you know, but that's about it. I didn't really, you know, I wasn't raised in a racist type home. We didn't really have, I think the only thing my mom ever said is don't marry a Catholic because I won't come to the wedding. I'm like, okay. You marry black people, don't marry no Catholic.
What did it mean in your family to be healthy when you were growing up?
We all had good health, I think. We did. I grew up, when I was 10 years old, we moved out to Richfield, and we lived on a farm. My mom and dad bought that in 1962. We moved out there in 64. So we were doing raising a garden. We had a garden in the house in Albemarle, too. So we were learned, you know, to work. Everybody pitched in. You had five kids. It took a lot to, as soon as you're old enough to start to do, like pushing the lawnmower or, you know, bringing the clothes down to do wash. Now the work was distributed. My mom didn't do it all herself, or dad. Growing up on a farm was great. At 10 years old, I was driving tractors. Matter of fact, the first time I did that, my dad rode around with me the first time. And it was a tractor that was great big. This tractor was huge. I mean, literally, it was, the wheels were like about 50, 60 inches high. First time my daddy rode around with me and behind me, he was just pulling the disc that you couldn't lift up. You know, you just had to drive straight. I could barely reach the clutch, you know, to get it in the gear. And I had ridden on his lap a bunch and, you know, steered it and all that. And so he rode around with me one couple of laps. Then he walked beside me for a lap. And then after that, he watched me do it a couple more laps. And then he went in the house. And my mom's like, "Where's Jeffrey? He's out there running that." And much as my mom about had a fit. But, you know, you learn to do it right. You know, I was taught how to do it safely, you know, what to do, how to shut it off. So, you know, don't do anything outside of what we were told. And so, you know, growing up was great. We did a lot of work. We raised a lot of our own food. Literally, we had a big garden. And we canned food and stuff like that, so we have all year long. No real health issues. I had a hernia when I was a little kid, and I had a brain concussion one day at school, running in from school and tripped over a root and hit my head. And but outside of that, no, you know, just normal, you know, measles and stuff like that, the typical childhood stuff. I remember when they had a polio vaccine. The salt vaccine was on the sugar cubes. And I remember when we were kids going by, and it was like three Sundays in a row. And we went by what's actually the senior center now. That was the Army Reserve Center. And they had a line set up, and you go there, and they had this all on sugar cubes. And, you know, and then, you know, how many in the car, and they give everybody, and they write down the names and stuff. They kept track of, and everybody, we thought that was cool. You got a sugar cube. All right. We didn't get a lot of sugar like that, so that was fun. But we did lots of, we were always out, active, never really had any big issues with health and stuff, because like I say, you were out eating good food. My mom was cooking stuff, you know, from scratch. You didn't have the processed foods like you have now, so most of our, you know, actually, I remember when the Chef Boyardee pizza kit was, oh, wow, we're getting a pizza tonight, you know, and my dad would buy the kit and then add a bunch of stuff to it, but we just didn't have a whole lot of processed food. You know, my mom cooked mainly from scratch, so when I was on the farm, we raised our own beef, so we had plenty of beef. You know, we ate a lot of that all year long. We'd, you know, feed a cow out and slaughter them, and you'd have enough food for about a year or more, so.
And so what made you decide to stay in the area after school?
That's a good one. I just liked it here. I really do. And I've had a lot of opportunity to travel. When I worked for a company in the post-college out of Burlington, we did a lot of work. We traveled the country. Right? Basically, we were doing sound for, you know, Amway conventions. And I did rent audio equipment and stuff like that, and traveled all over the United States. And of all the places I went, I said, you know, I still like it here best. Now, most of my brothers, all my brothers and sisters basically have stayed here except for one. He moved away to Arkansas, and he's in South Carolina now, but he's building a place now on the farm, family farm we grew up on. He's, you know, fixing to come back here to retire. So my wife and I, we decided her brother and sister, they both left and went, one to Winston-Salem, one's up in Asheville area. And we just decided, you know, we're going to raise a family. Stanley County is a great place. It's a horrible place to grow up, but it's a great place to raise kids. If you make, when your kid is like, there's nothing to do here. But, you know, that's kind of good because there's not a lot of place for trouble to get in trouble. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you met your wife?
Her dad was a professor at Pfeiffer College. And she's about four or five years younger than me. Actually, I think the first time I met her was when she got on my school bus. I was her school bus driver. And, you know, later on, as I, you know, went, she's like my brother, my younger brother's age. So in a small community like Richfield, you do know people. I mean, really. When I went to Pfeiffer, you know, I was driving the school bus. That was my junior, senior year. So when I went to Pfeiffer, then her dad was a professor there. Got to know him and stuff. And you know, like I say, it's a small community. She went to church here at Wesley Chapel. At that time, I didn't go to church here, but we would come over here for church functions, you know, like Bible school, stuff like that. So, yeah, we knew who they were and everything. And then in college years, when I finished up college, when she started, so had some overlap there, and you know, just knew her, and it wasn't a meeting, so to speak, whatever. But then I moved away actually for about a year and a half to Burlington to work for a while, and then came back here, and I was 29. Then I said, well, it's time to settle down, so I started looking around, and I don't know. Sharon was, okay, hi, let's talk. Matter of fact, in October of 83, there was a homecoming at Pfeiffer, and I saw her on campus, and my sister and her friend, myself, we were all going up to the local tavern. That was the night spot for adults at the time, John's Tavern, and invited Sharon to come along. And so after that, we started dating, and 11 months later, we're married. So, could have been sooner now, but she didn't want to. I wanted to get married on April 1st, but she said she wouldn't marry me on April Fool's Day. Just wasn't going to do that.
And so, y'all chose to live in Richfield or Meissenheimer?
Yeah, when we first got married, we lived with her mom. Her mom and dad had divorced by then and had a great big five-bedroom house. So we stayed there for a couple months until we could find a place. Alton Crowell used to rent a part. He had some duplexes on Old Salisbury Road. And we waited, I think it's about 6 months before one came open. And they were great because it was a one-bedroom duplex. You had a bathroom, bedroom, and a living room and a kitchen area. And it was reasonable rent. We could afford to rent. So as soon as we could get one of those places, we moved there. And then, you know, just kept moving around here. Actually, we rented a whole lot going multiple places until I finally built us a house. And we moved that in 2001. And then I sold it. And now I'm building another house. So.
And tell me about what the two of you did for a living.
Sharon, when I started dating her, she was working. Stanley County had a daycare center. They operated over in South Albemarle. And it was a county-operated center, basically for, you know, lower-income folks. Of course, right there on the edge of the black side of town, mostly black kids. And she worked there as a lead teacher. Later on, she became the director of it. And then she left there and went to work for the state as a licensing consultant, basically doing the licensing reviews for daycare centers. And did that total. Before that, she did. The county got out of the daycare business, and they started doing a purchase for care, where they would, you know, just take, instead of operating their own center, they would fund, you know, people to go to other centers. And she ran that program for that while, and then went to the state as a consultant. So she did that until she retired. Myself, I started working at 9. Before 9, my first job before that was, I was an entrepreneur. We used to have to, when I was growing up in Albemarle on Cannon Avenue, there's a lot of big oak trees and stuff. So, you know, my dad would have us all out there raking leaves every fall, the whole family, everybody had a rake. And I got the idea, you know what? I bet you I could get paid doing this. And I actually took my rake, went two doors up to Mr. Watts' house and asked. I knocked on his front door, and I said, my rake, you know. I said, well, Mr. Watts, how much would you charge me to rake your yard? And he got a kick out of that, I think. He let me rake his front yard or something. He probably gave me like a nickel or a quarter or something. I thought I was something else. But at 9 years old, my brother, older brother, had a newspaper route with Standing News and Press, and it was considered a car route. It was 120 customers. So he split the route. He did 80 people. I did 40. So at nine and 10 years old, I was doing a paper route. We moved up to the farm when I was 10, so worked on the farm. So that's like having a job, but just, you know, room and board is what you got paid. but I did a lot of work, you know, tractors. Since my dad worked a full-time job, I did, especially as old enough, I would do a lot of the plowing, disking, that kind of stuff, get the fields ready, you know, help them, you know, planting and stuff like that. Through high school, did that kind of stuff. Drove a school bus for, you know, little pocket money. Then through college years, I did hustling, what I call hustling, you know, a little bit here, do something here. I used to take kids to the airport and stuff and get paid for doing that. After college, I got into all along in there. I also played in different bands. That probably cost more money than I made, but we had a good time doing that, playing, you know, rock bands and stuff. After college, I started DJing and then, you know, doing other jobs and stuff. Got into Amway, worked in textile mills, did a lot of different types of jobs. First job out of college was a real job, was like working at a textile mill as an industrial engineer trainee. Because my dad was an industrial engineer, so that worked out pretty good. And that lasted for a couple months, not real long. And then I did a number of other jobs, got into manufacturing, did some work with multiple companies doing that. In the 80s, I got into a place called Abex Friction Products. Worked with Union Carbide Corporation, Eveready Battery Products, in the late 70s. Got work there as a first-line supervisor and then a quality supervisor. I did a little bit of everything at that place, real good. Went to work at a company that manufactured audio cassette tapes. Did the mastering of the tapes and stuff like that. Went to work at did a stint trying to, a buddy of mine said, we're going to get rich, we're going to be contractors. We're down to the Baden, there's a guy down there, had some houses. These were like what they call shotgun houses. These were like real low end houses black people were living in them. Actually, the guy who owned them, his mama had been a custodian at Pfeiffer, really sweet lady, and her son was, he had these houses, and they could fix them up to a certain level. They had to do some remodeling. Like most of these houses only had like one spigot running for water and maybe a couple electrical outlets. That was it. People were living in these houses. I mean, this was in the 1970s, 80s, and he had to do some remodeling. The other guy and I, we said, we can get rich remodeling these houses. We didn't really, but we did do a lot of work on the houses. He had to, you know, put electricity in, then he could get government money to help people live in. After that, I worked at Mobile Home Factory and then worked at a place in Salisbury called Abex Friction Products. Went to work there. Worked there for 11 years, first line supervisor, materials manager, purchasing. Went from there to Metal Forge in Albemarle. Worked there for a production control coordinator, quality manager, a quality engineer, quality manager. And then after there, went to a place in Concord, passing Seymour. Excuse me, there's another place in Charlotte. They made our synthetic paper. Worked there for a couple of years, and then went to passing Seymour in Concord, North Carolina. And stayed there for 13 years up until just a few months ago. So.
And how have you mentioned a lot of manufacturing organizations? Are many of those still open?
Most of them are gone. Based on what I've read and stuff, like 1977 was peak manufacturing, and that's when I started manufacturing. I've watched manufacturing decline over the years. And it's, you can get real political here real quick. I really see it's an effort to remove manufacturing because that's the strength and wealth of America. You don't make money reselling stuff. You make it by creating it. And, yes, it's tough now because manufacturing has been, you know, they incentivized to move it out of the country, you know, get it from somewhere else, and that's just not a real good way to do things. I'm really happy, actually, the current administration is actually working to bring back things. You know, when people, you know, when I was like 16 years like that, I don't know if you remember all the mills that used to be in Albemarle, you know, where it's all open now. It's open, big open field. That was all people's jobs. There was factories. That was a mile down there from, you know, where the ballpark is up to Salisbury Avenue. That was a mile of manufacturing. That was all buildings of people making stuff. And it's all gone. It's all bulldozed. But, you know, back then, a person could, and a lot of people do this, quit at 16, quit school, and go to work. And, they, you know, they get a car, and, you know, in a year or so, they could get married, and they could actually support a family. And there's no way you can do that now. But, you know, there was manufacturing jobs. You know, now that same person, you're lucky if you can get a job at Wendy's or, you know, a fast food or something like that. So, yes, it's been a big change in the availability. And I say every summer, boy, it was just a matter of where you want to work. You could go find summer work just about anywhere. And now it's so hard. There's not that many jobs for kids to do, which takes away from them learning how to, you know, the ethics of work ethic and how to produce and, you know, get that first check. You know, say, I made this. This is my money. You know, I earned this. So I did a lot of, like, say, you know, work through. I could get summer jobs as a quilted bedspread factory over here in Richfield, Richfield Manufacturing. You know, I worked there a couple summers. I worked construction. So there was always plenty of things you could do, plenty of work you could find. I just don't think that those opportunities are as good now for kids that they were back when I was young.
What kind of opportunities do you think people have now for jobs when they get out of high school?
Most of it's service jobs. If you really think about it, like my son just graduated from community college. I have a biomedical equipment technology degree. But basically what he's doing is fixing something that somebody else made. It's a service job. You know, and that's where the future is right now. But, you know, the manufacturing needs to be brought back to really, if you want to, right now we have a, you know, deficit payments going out. That's our wealth leaving our country and going to other places because they're making the stuff. And, you know, fortunately right now I see a lot of that getting reversed, and that's good. And people are wailing about it. But, you know, that's really, if you want to have a truly strong country, you need to be making your own stuff, not being dependent on other people.
So what would you do to fix that?
Make it more profitable. More incentivize people to do it. And you don't have to do a whole lot. You know, just make one, you know, make it harder to bring stuff in from other places. The people will start up, you know, business startups, small business, stuff like that will start up and fill that need. It will create more opportunities for people who want to do different things. I think too many people got some of these college degrees that don't really create new stuff, you know. So, and some of this, it's like, you know, you hear some of these titles, like, really, I mean, I have a business degree in economics, and that was a good degree for going to lots of different places. Technical trades now, actually, like I say, my son, my daughter went to NC State and got a degree in communications there. Nathan finished up at the community college, and he's making as much money as she is and on a two-year degree. In a couple more years, he will be making way more than her once he gets a little farther along in that career. I told him, I said, if you can be the person that can fix that CAT scan machine when nobody else can, I said, you're going to get six figures, you know. robotics come into medical. You know, in the future, there's going to be all this robotic stuff. I said, and Nathan, he's going to be perfectly positioned to be in that field. So, yeah, there's technical fields out there. Once again, there's services as far as manufacturing. It would be good to bring that back to get, you know, where people can learn that work and, you know, actually create wealth for the country.
Are there other ways that you've seen that Stanley County change in the past 20 or 30 years?
Probably the biggest thing in Stanley County is the exodus of manufacturing. It's big. And I think now that the top two employers in Stanley County are the hospital and the Board of Education. And that's, yeah, their services. Yeah, those things you need and everything, but they don't create wealth, they consume it. Figuring out how to get manufacturing back here. Unfortunately, I think because of some political activity in the past, it's going to be hard to get that back here. The current local management, you know, the commissioner and stuff like that, aren't too good on bringing it back. Actually, matter of fact, back in the 70s, we had an economic development guy, and Ed Cochran, and he was great. He brought in a lot of stuff. If you've ever been over by Walmart and all back there's, you know, there's a Metal Forge and there's a Preformed Line Products, Cargill, there was some mobile home factories, a bunch of stuff back in there. And Ed Cochran was the one who brought that stuff here. He brought this, and this was like in the 70s, and it was going great until they were able to, these were companies mostly coming from other places, like mostly from up north. Metal Forge is a perfect example. They came from Ohio, came down here, and they were able to pay half what they were paying for union labor up there, for non-union labor here. And still, that was above what the local people were getting. It was, $4 or $5 more an hour. And all of the best and the brightest in the textile mills were going over there. And the good old boys, the textile mills, didn't like that because now they're going to have to pay more to keep their good people. And they actually shut down the economic development. And a few years later after that, in 1997, I believe it was, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Stanley County was listed there as the most depressed county in the Southeast. Made the front page of the Wall Street. I saw the article. And basically what it was, you know, Ross Perot had talked about this. If you pass NAFTA and GATT, and you, what you'll see is this giant sucking sound as all the manufacturing leaves. And it was. Because my wife, she was working at Social Services. I told her, be ready, because if that stuff passes, then all that textile mills will stop. And all those people are going to be coming to see you to try to feed their families and stuff. And sure enough, that's what happened. That's just, don't like that. Yeah, but it was kind of funny because in that Wall Street article, Wall Street Journal article, some of the guys who actually ran mills in town, that one of them, particular one, was a mayor at the time, he was wailing, oh, all this thing, da 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 da. Like, you're the guys who shut down economic development here, because we were all focused on textiles and that diversification that Ed Cochran tried to bring in here, or Jim Cochran is the name. That money. The new business he brought in here, if we had been that diversified in other types of manufacturers outside of textiles, we'd been in a lot better shape. But after, Alcoa moved out and stuff like that, and there was a lot of political stuff about Alcoa, the county commissioners trying to take over, the assets and stuff like that, that's not going to help our economic development here. It's going to take a long time for outside companies to come back here. Sorry, but that's my thing of it.
Thank you for sharing. What do you think are some of the, you've talked about some of the challenges in Stanley County. What do you think are some of the assets of Stanley County?
One of the biggest assets is that we are so, actually being behind has helped a lot because we don't have a lot of big city problems. Charlotte, of course, is a big mega city. Even Concord and stuff, we're not immune to that, the drugs and the stuff like that that causes, brings violence with it. But we still do have a whole lot more conservative type. Even the Democrats here are conservative. I mean, that sounds a little strange, but they're not as liberal. Most of them are not, they're more better work ethic. I think that's still pretty good work ethic here. The recreational opportunities are fabulous here. We're in a very good point. Mar Mountain State Park, Albemarle's working on a lot of recreational facilities. Matter of fact, Albemarle's led in parks and stuff like that since Chuck Moorhead was over the parks and rec back in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And Albemarle's way ahead. Richfield Park is... When they built Richfield Park, and that was just, a couple people really pushing that, and that was way ahead. We're still way ahead for a park that nice and that size in a town of 500 people, 600 people. And now we have the Carolina Thread Trails connection here, the Falcon Trail from Meisenheimer all the way to that park, and then later on that will connect down to Albemarle. So the recreational opportunities are fabulous. You got Warri National Forest, you got Lake Tillery, all the lakes, the Yadkin PD River. It's lots of opportunities for recreation. There's a lot of things I think that could bring in, a higher quality of life. If you could bring back in the right kind of manufacturing to, once again, create that wealth.
And you mentioned that it's conservative in a good way. What do you mean by that?
People still a strong influence of religion here. And I think there's still, you know, a lot of, I can see, you know, like our church here over the years has declined in membership and all. Because I can remember when the pews were pretty much full on Sunday. Some of that's, you know, like Pfeiffer, but Pfeiffer has changed a lot over the years. As it's grown bigger and stuff, more people come outside. It's actually most of the, at one time, of course, there was nothing out here, so they had, Pfeiffer had the faculty houses. So that all those faculty went to church here in this area. Now, over the years, they sold off those houses, so the faculty scattered out more of a bigger area. So they're not necessarily right here in my time. They might be New London, Richfield, Albemarle, Concord. So it does spread out some. But the still strong family unit here, like I said, good work ethic for, most people. And I think there's a lot of people that are willing to work. They'd like to work if they could find work. So that is one of our strong points. We do have great education opportunities. You got Pfeiffer, Stanley Community College, is a strong school, and you can teach a lot of trades that you can use right here. It's not like something you learn here and you have to go somewhere else to do. So those are some of the bigger assets. I think it's affordable to live here right now. So. My son's, he's been looking at trying to get an apartment in Concord. I'm saying, you can rent an apartment here and drive there cheaper than you can, and still save money or just cost just for the rent in Concord. So, like I say, we have a better cost of living here, and that's a good thing. I think there's, we have abundant water. We're actually selling it to other, counties, Cabarrus and Union, trying to get one now, the water line. So we do have a lot of natural resources that we can utilize here.
What do you think, what does it mean to you to be from a small town or rural area, whichever way you would describe?
I'm proud of it. I mean, I love it. Now, my daughter moved to Raleigh, and she never come back here. And she likes it. She likes the big city life. This just was not big enough for her. I remember one time she and I went up to New Jersey. I was going up there to pick up some stuff. It was my aunt's furniture after she had passed away, and then some of that my brother-in-law. So I rented a van, went up there. Megan went with me. She was about 10 years old at the time, and we drove through Philadelphia, and she's like, "Oh, wow, look, there's a street person and stuff." So it was so funny. I took her to a real deli where you get a real submarine sandwich, not like what you get around here. It was just an eye-opener for her, and she's just like, "Wow," because all this big city, because we were driving out Sunday morning. We drove through Philadelphia on the edge of it, and it was beautiful, view of the skyline and all. So she got her eyes opened up. She got to travel a lot when she was young, and I thought, well, she'll never come here. Stanley County, I knew, but in summer schools, she stayed up in Raleigh during the summer. She wouldn't come back here. So. Nathan's kind of more like a homebody. He'd rather stay here, I think, but I think he's actually starting to want to move on. Like I say, there's not – there's not a lot of entertainment stuff. Actually, entertainment now is better than when I was growing up. Because at least now in Albemarle, they do have, alcoholic beverages, and back then they were not. Albemarle was dry back then, but Albemarle Stanley County total. You had to go to, like I say, John's Tavern, which is across the Rowan County line, was where we had to go. It's hard for the youth here, and one of the things I've seen in our church. A lot of these youth grow up and they get, especially when they go to college and stuff like that, and they move away because there's just not work here to do. That's why we really need to, invest in here and somehow get business to come back in. I'm hoping what, current administration is doing now will incentivize companies to, reinvest in America and put factories here. And that will help. That'll help a whole lot for making everything better.
If you could tell somebody who's never been to Meisenheim or Stanley County, what would you want them to know about it here?
It's a friendly place, good people here, real good people. It's a slower pace. It's not a big city. You don't have the crime and stuff that you have. There are bad people, but it's a lot fewer of them and a whole lot more noticeable here. But it is a great place to raise a family. Like I say, in the schools and stuff, you don't have all the problems you have, like over in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. It's a lot better place. It's more community. And we still have, especially now, we still have, you know, the distributed high schools. I think that helps a whole lot, you know, because you have that community around that school, even as you spread out, you know, three or four small towns still, you know, focus on North Stanley because that's where all the kids go to school. So it is still kind of a centralized and more of a family atmosphere. Like I say, you do know people. One thing I learned a long time ago, especially coming from outside this county, you don't talk bad about anybody because that person you just said something bad about, you know, you say something bad about, that's my third cousin's wife over there you're talking about. I'm like, okay. My aunt's, uncle's, brother's, sister's cousin, I'm a hoe. So you don't talk bad about nobody.
How do people around here usually get health care?
You have Standing Hospital, which is, I think they do a good job down there. In the later years here, my wife has the perception that we're better off at Cabarrus. And some of that may be because Cabarrus was a bigger hospital. Before Charlotte Carolina Healthcare said, Charlotte Memorial took over everything. I still remember Charlotte Memorial and, you know, Cabarrus Hospital, whatever. And Albemarle is good. The problem with Albemarle, one of the weaknesses here, is there's a lot of turnover of the doctors. And I noticed this one time, you know, they used to run ads all the time, you know, oh, new doctor, new doctor, new doctor. I'm like, we have a lot of new doctors, but what happened to all the other ones? And basically what they do, they come here and they'll work here for a couple of years, and maybe that's like an obligation through their education. You know, they got some kind of funding, whatever, you know, and do a couple of years in a rural, which is good because you're getting new ones, you know, out of college. So they usually, they're not experienced, but they do know the latest stuff. So you do have some good stuff. I think the people at Stanley do a great job. You know, I've had like a heart catheterization there once. The guy who did it actually came from Charlotte Cardiology. So, but he did it, you know, locally, which was nice. So I could get it done here and go home, you know, things like that. You can do that. Right now, we actually go to – we had a Cabarrus Family Medicine had a office here in Richfield, and Standing Memorial had an office there. And the Cabarrus one, I actually started going there after the doctor I had gone to for an Albemarle for years retired. So we went to the one in Richfield like that, and then they ended up moving it over to Mount Pleasant, so which is not too bad. That's about the same as driving to Albemarle. So my wife thinks that they do better over there. They probably do all about the same, really. Because what they'll do, they'll transfer you real fast, you know, especially now that it's all owned by the same company, basically. You know, Atrium now is taking it all over. They will move you around. They'll transfer you if they need to. And I know people that go to Stanley County and, okay, they move them over to Cabarrus because they're, you know, it's a higher level because it's a bigger hospital and stuff. So the healthcare is good available. Most of my life, I've worked in manufacturing, so I've had really good health care coverage. Matter of fact, when I worked at ABEX, my first went to work there, that was in 1988, and my health care was $10. I said, is that a week? No, it's a month. That was a family plan, $10 a month. We were owned by the Illinois Central Railroad. The company was owned by it. So, yeah, it was, they underwrote a lot of it. Now, over the 11 years I worked there, that changed a lot, and that rate went up a bunch. And even to now, it has. I'm right now, I'm 64, so I'm getting ready to, you know, December or January, I'll be transforming over to Medicare. So we'll see how this goes. I'm fortunate. I've had real good health most of my life. Not had a whole lot of issues. My wife, on the other hand, has had a lot of issues and a lot of use of health care. So,
can you tell me what it means to you to have a good health experience with a healthcare provider, like with your heart catheterization? What made it a good experience?
Well, the first one was my mother-in-law was a nurse for Dr. Kendall in Albemarle, and you know, when I had this issue, I couldn't get a hold of my regular doctor. I tried to call him, and then one night I was having a lot of burning, you know, in my chest and everything, and I think Presbyterian Hospital at the time was running all this advertising. You know, these are the signs of a heart attack, you know, and this burning sensation. Like, okay, and I don't know. Maybe it's because I was, you know, working a full-time job, building a house, raising a family, and a couple other things. You know, maybe some of that. You know, drinking 40 cups of coffee a day and smoking 2 packs of cigarettes. That might have had some effect on me. but I couldn't get a hold of my regular doctor, so my mother-in-law had her boss to come meet me at the hospital, and they did some tests and stuff on, and basically it turned out to be acid reflux. but they did do a heart catheterization just to be sure, but and that did, that was good, because that did actually, Dr. Kendall is a great doctor. He was the first one to ever sit in there and says, you know, you're fat, you're going to die. I've never had a day. He told you like it was. I think some doctors are too nice. They won't tell you the things you don't want to hear. But he was, I liked him. He's like, you're fat, you're going to die. He's like, I can show you here, you gain 10 pounds a year. And he's right. And then changing those habits is hard, but it's nice to know that you do have good doctors out there. That the ones we go to now, he's a real nice young man, smart and knowledgeable. I think he does a great job. He's got a good manner. And that does give you a lot more confidence. And it's nice to know that he's in a group that if you can't see him, you know, if you got a sinus infection, I got to have something now. You know, one of the, you know, PAs or whatever, they can do the same thing and take care of you, get you, you know, started on treatment. So, you know, putting in the PAs has helped a lot to free up the doctors for maybe the more serious stuff, whatever. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about your wife's experiences with healthcare providers?
She's got fibromyalgia, anemia, and some other things. She was a preemie when she was born, and I've always wondered, you know, because she was born back in the 50s at Bowman Gray Hospital, and I wonder if, you know, does that have a long-term effect on people? You know, if you were born premature, is there a correlation to that to later on health care? I don't know or not, but she started developing these issues probably back in the 2005 or so, like that. And in 2007, she actually took an FMLA to, you know, to be off a year to try to work through some of this. And she never did go back to work from that. So I think the problem's kind of, I think in some ways, this is just my personal opinion, that maybe doctors are too willing to prescribe. One of the things, I have great health insurance. You know, I can't help but think, oh, look, this guy's got, I got a buddy who can give you a pill for that. I've become a little more cynical about healthcare. I think it's too much about, you know, we got a pill for that. They're treating symptoms, not curing the root cause. I think for myself, you know, there's some things I've run into and all. I had my thumb, I was holding a hammer, and had, the way I had my thumb, it got inflamed in here in the joints. And I went to the doctor about it. He gave me some pills for the inflammation. I'm like, huh? And it took about a year later. Now the thumb's back working again, but I just didn't think, you know, he wanted to give me a pill for it. Now tell me what I did wrong, and what can we do about fixing that? You know, I think there's a lot of things that you can do now that not inside that pharmacy and the pharmaceutical medical complex, they call it. my wife, I think, is just too much looking for a magic pill. And, of course, like I say, doctors are always, I got a buddy who can do a pill for that. And it's a vicious cycle. I mean, she's taking like 15 prescriptions a day. I take one. Yeah, I'm like, you know, that's for a thyroid. And my mom had an underactive thyroid, so that's genetic, I believe. And I actually believe if I actually got my weight down where it should be, which I'm trying to work towards, that, yeah, I might be able to get rid of that one. I've been looking if I've got receding gums. And, you know, when my dentist told me, he said, well, you should have been flossing the last 30 years. I said, well, I didn't. So what's the cure? Well, the cure is we can do this. They can do operations. They can do these grafts and all this stuff. I'm like, so I go on the internet and start looking around. And the other day I found something, you know, where you can do, you know, more natural with a holistic, whatever they call it,
homeopathic cure.
Yeah. And this was like used to fight the receding gums. Well, one of the things that sodium lauryl sulfate, which is one of the prime ingredients in all toothpaste, guess what? That's bad for your gums. And you go looking, it's in everything. Actually, the last month or two, I've been using coconut oil and baking soda. I make it myself, put it together. That's I've been real good with that. But I get, because of the receding gums, it's withdrawing from my, you know, the roots of my teeth. But I found a thing the other day. It said, well, you use red sage tincture. If I can just find stuff, that will actually help you regrow your gums. Now, is that real or not? I don't know. Of course, it's on the internet. Sure, it's got to be right. but, you know, maybe there's more natural things. You know, how do people do a lot of this stuff before they had all these drugs? I do believe like there is too much of all the advertising on TV, and some of the stuff I see on TV is appalling. It's like, okay, you know, this will cure this little thing, but you know, you might have cancer, you might get, you know, da 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 da. You know, 15. I'm like, sound like you're gonna die of this stuff, and I just don't wonder if maybe some of that stuff is creating more issues. I think it is for my wife, creating more issues than it's helping. Because, you know, she's gone. There was one doctor we went to in UNC Chapel Hill Hospital. And this guy, he was the first one, said, we really need to start taking you off all these drugs. And it never went farther than that. So I think he did one or two. But, you know, you need to back off. With my wife, I've not been able to convince her that maybe we need to change our food, change how we eat, you know, our exercise, stuff like that. But she wants a pill, and she's gotten this, you know, watching the advertisement, there's a pill for everything, how come I can't get it? No, sometimes you just have to, like, you know, do the right thing. Your bodies are not designed for maybe all this processed food, especially the GMO stuff and all. I'm trying to do better about eating that, you know, getting healthier stuff. But my wife, you know, if I make healthy food, you know, she'll say, it just doesn't taste right, you know. Well, you know what, if you eat it, for a while, I was working, eating like a little breakfast shake thing, whatever, and then maybe once a week go to Bojangles for, you know, a biscuit. And it's like my Friday treat. But, you know, after doing that shake for a while, that biscuit didn't taste as good. And it's like, you know, you're used to one thing, but if, you know, if you get away from it and go back to it, it's like some of that food, manufactured food, doesn't taste that good once you get away from it long enough to realize that maybe there's stuff in here I shouldn't be eating. And I think a lot of health can be fixed by, you know, more about nutrition and healthy foods versus, you know, all the stuff that the convenience foods that they have in the stores.
If you could wave a magic wand to help fix the health care, you mentioned some issues with it, what would you suggest?
Tort reform, number one. The reason health care is so expensive is because it's too easy to sue. You know, somebody has a bad outcome. You know, it could be outside of actual malpractice. I mean, if a doctor viciously or something did something just horribly wrong, and, you know, you have review boards that can handle that. But outside of that, you know, it's bad, they leave a sponge in you. Or if you don't survive a surgery, maybe it's because, you know, you waited till, you know, too late. But the thing is, it's like a financial roulette wheel here. You know, let's get rich on the bad operation or the bad outcome. And I think that, you know, I read one time that in Japan, they don't have much trouble with malpractice suits because in order to sue somebody there, you have to post a bond for the amount of money you're suing them for. If you lose the case, that person gets the money and you have to pay for all the lawyers. I think, like I say, once again, the tort reform would help a whole lot, make it harder to sue or reducing the amount of, you know, the money you can get. What was that actual damage? You know, the diet, because that death been prevented. If it's not actual malpractice, you know, real obvious malpractice thing, they really should get rid of these lawyers being able to sue on stuff. I think that would help. That will help bring that cost down a lot. I know a lot of doctors, they overprescribe, tests. Oh, we got to do and four tests here, and it's. Does that really know what it is, or is that to, you know, cover yourself in a future lawsuit? And I think there's a lot of that going on out there. They have to do that to, you know, to just be sure, because somebody will come back, you know, oh, you didn't think about this over here, this off the wall issue. I think that's a lot of it. I think you're talking about manufacturing and all. One of the things that has destroyed healthcare in the United States is. Excuse me, the exporting of manufacturing. If you go back to health insurance and health care, the whole health insurance business grew out of World War II. In World War II, companies, or they had wage and price freezes, during the war, to keep people from gouging or over profiteering, and corporations needed people to come work in their factories to help the war effort, and they couldn't raise wages. Wages were fixed, so they started offering benefits, and that's where healthcare started. That's where employer healthcare started in World War II. And then, of course, in the post-World War II baby boom and all, once again, the economies are exploding, expanding so big, and as an extra incentive, they had better and better health care plans. I had an operation when I was about 7 or 8 years old. This was my hernia operation. I got the invoice my dad had was $110. That's to get operated on the whole. Now, I don't know if the doctor, I don't think the surgeon was that, but that was the hospital bill, $110. that surgery now costs what, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000? So what's changed so much? How much of that is covering themselves? Of course, now before Obamacare and everything, there was a whole lot of if you showed up at a hospital, you got care, really. but it was covered by people who had insurance paying more money. So there's. In my opinion, what they ought to do is go back to the old system that had health departments in the county. Instead of people now, they show up, in the emergency room for basic care. They've started working now on these urgent care centers and all that. That's helping a lot there. But a couple of years ago, my wife was, she had overextended herself, and she was going, she was in like, she was incoherent. She was in kind of a fog and everything. And I ended up taking her over to Cabarrus Hospital emergency room. And I'm sitting in a room, and there's about 60 people or more in there sitting in. And, some of them families here, okay, whatever. But, some of these things, I'm not seeing what they're – my wife, she's in a wheelchair. She can barely handle it. She's in, and actually, it wasn't until I went up to the thing. I said, can you watch my wife for a minute? I'm going to get my car. I'm going to take her somewhere else where she gets seen. We already been sitting there for an hour and a half. And she's just like, she's, and she was, when they took her, they finally, the guy, whoa, 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 and he took her back in, and she was there for 8 more hours. She was totally dehydrated, and, until they got her, back hydrated and everything. But there's all these people over here that, they're, what are you here for now? And why are you, could that not have been taken care of during the day? Back in those days, you had the health department. So, if you were in, if you did not have the resources, you could go there and get. Why don't we have that still? That might be a better way to deliver healthcare versus clogging up the emergency rooms with people who are doing, maybe things that don't need to be treated that same level of care.
You mentioned Obamacare. How do you think that's impacted healthcare for people in this community?
I know for myself. Now, I don't know how it's affected, people didn't have insurance. I know my rates went up 40-50%, and I'm not getting better care. My out-of-pocket I had to pay was at least 40% a couple years in a row. So, first off, it was a lie. There's no way the government can take over and insure 40 million more people and it go down. Hello. Anybody that any business sense knows that that's not going to happen. That was a big lie from the get-go. The insurance companies are alleged to have written this policy, whatever. So it was a way to edge out a lot of the marginal ones. And by the government taking over, everybody knows the government cannot more efficiently run something. There's nowhere in the Constitution they even supposed to be in that field. Believe me, there's nothing in there that they should be doing it. Ideally, if you're going to have any government intervention in healthcare, it should be at the state level. You should be allowed to buy insurance across state lines. I think actually Trump just recently did some things like to make that happen. The fact that I have to pay for a lot of things that I'll never use, spreading it out, but I'm never going to have to need obstetrician. I'm never going to need an obstetrician for me. Now, my wife needed a couple times for 2 children, but we're at the point now we're not going to have any more children, so we're still paying for everybody else to have an obstetrician. I see a lot of things, something that kind of interests me. Now there's some of these doctors that are getting away from all the insurance and things, and they're doing co-ops where you subscribe to their services, like $1,200 a year, you become a member of that doctor's services. And you can get that stuff and, you know, get the visit. I think you pay a $50 or something when you actually go to get around all this. And it's pretty straightforward, and you sign a waiver that you will not sue them. Hello. So, and a lot of these guys don't, you know, they get rid of all that staff, and that's a lot better way to run a healthcare business. Like I said, you still need the big hospitals because there are things that you have to have that kind of talent stuff for. Probably the hardest thing for me to wrestle with is the ethics of at what point do you quit giving care? You know, we have now the capability, you know, the neonatal intensive cares. And, you know, we have a friend that's got a granddaughter, and she had a heart issue. I'm not exactly sure exactly what it was, but she's already probably had $1 million health care. She's just now a senior. She's a rising senior in high school. Sweet young lady and all. But you sit there and think, you know, do we have to do this for everybody? It's a hard, I mean, like I say, this is a sweet young lady. I love her to death, but, you know, there's a lot of kids out there to get care that, you know, at what point is there a return on that? Or it's a hard thing, you know, because, you know, as a Christian, you try to do what you can, but at what point is that? You know, elderly, at what point do you stop doing everything? You know, watching, you know, my wife's grandmother, you know, she declined in health over the years. My parents, fortunately, both went pretty, you know, heart attacks, so they didn't, it was kind of sudden. There was not a long, prolonged, you know, decline in health. But, you know, watch my wife's grandmother, you know, go from, you know, assisted care down all the way to intensive, you know, to, and even after they had do not resuscitate and stuff like that, it's still, you know, that step down until you actually pass away. At what point do you say, okay, that's enough? It's a hard decision or a hard thing to think about both ways. But you have to kind of like, at what point do you?
How do you think those decisions could be made or should be made?
That's the troubling part there. Yes, you know, who makes that decision? Is you know, some. I think one of the things, you know, of course, when they're doing Obamacare, a lot of people say, "Oh, you know, the death panels, or whatever." And yeah, now is that some bureaucrat somewhere? You know, is that a doctor that makes? I think your doctor should be the one who makes that decision. You know, that he should be unchained to make that decision of whether it's worth keeping that care going. Yeah, of course, that's going to be hard because everybody's going to say, hey, that's my grandma. You know, we want to keep Granny here. Well, you know, Granny's a vegetable, but, you know, and you just can't go out and shoot people or something like that. I mean, no way. You don't want to do any. Or, you know, there are people. I saw a thing where California has assisted suicides or whatever. Some people may, that option is if somebody makes that decision themselves, they want to do that. You know, they should be able to make that decision. I don't think I would ever want to do that myself, but, you know, I've known people that got cancer and they decided, no, I'm not going through all that street, you know, and commit suicide. They didn't ask nobody. They just did it themselves and, you know, left a note saying why. And maybe that's, you know, I don't know. You get into so many religious and ethical decisions in there, and confusion is tough to think about what is the best way to do that.
What do you think how does your religion shape the decisions that you make about healthcare?
Well, I believe that, you know, I personally, like, against abortion, and, you know, for that reason, I don't think government should be involved in that. I don't think you should be doing it for. You shouldn't have abortion for health care. What am I trying to say here? As a mean of contraception, avoidance or whatever. You know, that shouldn't. There are other things you can do to avoid having a child or whatever. My wife had a. When she was in her senior year in college, she got pregnant. And this was back in the 80s, and this in a small community like Meisenheim, because that's where she was going to college. And, you know, of course, then that was absolutely scandalous. She went off to live with an aunt for a year or something like that. and she ended up having a baby and released it for adoption. And 20-some years later, we got to meet baby. She, this was, Sharon had signed up on adoption.com because she always thought about her baby because it was born 2 days before her birthday. And, you know, she let me know this before we got married and stuff and all. And, you know, I supported that she had the baby and, you know, and gave it to somebody who couldn't have a baby. And Leah was actually raised by a guy, he's actually a doctor. He went to Bowman, him and his wife were here. He was going to Bowman Gray Medical School at the time when they adopted her. And he is actually ended up, he was at Baylor University, head of the Department of Family stuff. You know, she had a great life, you know, and I can't help thinking that was the right decision that Sharon made. This was long before I started dating her, but she made the right decision and gave that child to somebody who couldn't have children. And I think that's great. I don't think you should do it as, you know, okay, I had a little too much fun Friday night. Let's go to, you know, the clinic on Monday and get, you know, I don't think that's a right thing to do. Healthcare for regular stuff. I believe, you know, God heals in many ways. You know, he gives us that ability to have doctors and surgeons that can, you know, or chemists that can give us, you know, things that, you know, stop infection, can, you know, cure, you know, a defective heart or something like that and prolong life. That's good, I think. I think it's good and ethical. But there's, you know, so much, there's some other things in there. But, you know, if you're doing it for change your gender, really, that this is not... I think that's something totally different. If people want to do that, go ahead and do it. Just, you know, don't make me pay for it. You do what you want. You pay for it. I mean, you can deal with that. As far as, you know, I know there's people out there in certain religious groups that think that, you know, health care is bad and evil and all that. No, you know, God gave us these abilities to do this stuff. So, you know, we should use that. That's part of his reaching out to help, you know, you know, keep your life going, you know, so you can live more, you know, to be, you know, for his glory, whatever. So I think from that point, it's good.
Are there any specific health challenges that you think are more or less present here in Stanley County than in other parts of the state?
I know in down around Aquadale area, there was sometimes there was a plant down there that recycled waste and stuff like that. It was actually what they were doing. They were burning rock. I forget the name of the place now, but back in the 90s or something. And there was a lot of controversy because they were using hazardous chemicals and waste, hazardous waste, to fire their kilns. And, you know, there was people, there was a bunch of concern about whether that was polluting any of the local wells and stuff. And there have been some areas where there have been some, you know, environmental pollution, stuff like that. It has affected people's health. I know Alcoa, a lot of people, I used to remember seeing so many times that somebody you see in the 25-year club or 35-year club, they retired and boom, they died. Alcoa, you know, is probably the biggest environmental issue that has been in Stanley County, especially in the last 10, 20 years. You got to keep in mind, though, that most of the 70 years, the first 70 years of operation, there were no environmental laws. It wasn't until the 1970s that came along. And you know, refining aluminum is a pretty nasty business. I mean, that first, and they were doing primary reduction, taking the bauxite powder and, you know, extracting aluminum from it. So, and, you know, like I say, once again, most of those years, they did not have that level of safety and health concerns. I was fortunate. I went to work at Union Carbide in Ashburn. That was in the late 70s, and they had a very strong safety program, containment program, you know, safety training for supervisors and for employees. As a supervisor, I was always I required every month to turn in so many times where I saw somebody doing a safety violation. Probably the only thing I ever ran into that whole time I worked there was we had a in the mixing room where they mix some of the chemicals and stuff that goes into, we're making flashlight batteries. And somebody dropped a container of mercury. So now you got mercury now. When I was a little kid, we'd break open thermometers to play with the mercury on the table. And they used to, yeah, look at this. That's cool. Here's a little bead. You push two beads together. And we didn't think, hey, you lick your hand. Okay, yeah, we're good. but this particular incident, the place that they did it, it was on a wood floor that had a lot of cracks in it. So I'm like, I know Mercury's right. Like, okay, this is something we have to worry about. So I called my boss and asked him if I was a second shift supervisor. And he said, well, just get it swept up as best you can, contain it into a 5-gallon bucket. And that's what we did. And next fact, the guy was working on it. We got it all, like I say, it was still down some of those cracks in the boards, but we got most of it up. And, you know, we put down some like sawdust, wet sawdust to help, you know, attach it to it, and identified it and locked it up. And then they disposed of it the next day. But, you know, sometimes your environmental work, you have problems like that. You know, Alcoa, yeah, they probably did have some environmental issues over there. Most of them, I think, have been resolved, or they're at least identified and being monitored. But, you know, over the years, people did get exposed to that. A lot of it just because we didn't know at that time. I think nowadays, you know, in the place where I was working, we had an environmental ISO 14001 environmental certification. And, you know, we certified any outside vendors coming in that you will do stuff. We did everything in our plant, you know, proper containment of, you know, hazardous materials and how you dispose of it, you know. We had to contain it and then, you know, properly send it to recycling places or whatever, disposal places. So we've become a lot more aware of it. I think that's helped a lot. That's, you know, that will keep healthy people healthier. When I worked at Abex in Salisbury, that was, we made brake linings. And of course, you know, asbestos was a big number one. Asbestos was used as a reinforcement in the brake lining. It's also heat resistant. It's a natural fiber. By the time I got to the place there, they were using fiberglass instead of asbestos. And I couldn't help but wonder, you know, how about another 20 years from now, we'll say, oh, instead of, you know, asbestosis, it's fibriosis or something, you know, because this is an inorganic material. Could that just be as dangerous as, you know, if you breathe it in? Yeah. So, I mean, like our places, in certain places, you had to wear face masks to help. So I think, you know, industry has become a lot more cognizant of these things. And a lot of them do it because it's a cost avoidance. Because you, if you know, a good safety program will save you money, because you keep your employees healthy, you keep them from having those long-term illnesses, you keep them working that better. So it's cost benefit if you'll look at it that way.
Well, thank you for the things that you have shared this afternoon. Is there anything else you think I've missed asking about, or that you would like to share?
I just like, you know, in healthcare, I think that they really need to go back some. First off, I think government needs to get out of it. Bringing back manufacturing will help a lot, because as businesses start competing again for employees, they will take care of that, and they will find the most cost-effective way to do it. You know, the company I work for, we're self-insured, so they would, you know, find ways. You know, they had health fairs and things where you can do encouraging. They if you would do a certain things, you know, certain healthy things, they would, you know, discount your insurance for, you know, $100 or $200. You know, there's incentive out there to do healthier lifestyles to, you know, reduce your premiums, because it helps the company reduce the premiums. And I think we need to get more back over to the private sector. Like I say, government never does anything efficiently. It's not going to work. You have too much bureaucracy, too much. And you took health care away from so many families that had it and gave it to people who, you know, didn't have it. But, you know, then it made for people who were working and stuff a whole lot harder. You know, maybe we need to find manufacturing, you know, another source of those people to get health care privately funded versus the government do it. So that would probably be the biggest thing to helping, you know, that and tort reform to reform health care.
Well, thank you for all your thoughts.
All right, thank you.